With the new year coming, you may be thinking about a resolution, more exercise, maybe doing a little yoga. Our commentator, Sandeep Roy, will not be joining you.
True confession, I am an Indian who doesn't do yoga. I wouldn't know a downward dog if it bit me. But because I'm Indian, people don't even ask if I know yoga. They ask, what kind of yoga did you grow up with? Iyengar, Ashtanga, Bikram? Actually, most Indians I know don't do yoga either. My friend Rajasvini Bhansali is an exception, and she's often the only Indian in class.
The instructor pointed to me in the middle of the class and talked about how Indians are better oriented towards doing squats. And I realized he was holding me up as an example of how us primitive people are just better squatters and therefore have looser hips.
I always thought I wasn't thick-skinned enough to survive yoga class. Then I heard the Hindu American Foundation had launched a campaign to take back yoga and reclaim its Hindu roots. I was alarmed. What if they really took it back and I wasn't ready? I decided to fix my yoga deficit disorder. So I show up at my first yoga class in San Francisco. It's steamy hot. There are over 100 people, and sure enough, my friends and I are the only 4 Indians. The instructor is from Tennessee, blonde, shirtless, and a bit of a yoga rock star. There are disco balls on the ceiling and huge posters of Krishna on the wall. I am just amazed at all the stuff. Yoga tops, bottoms, blankets, mats. My vision of a yogi was a guy in the forest sitting on a piece of tree bark, or in the deluxe version, a deer skin. He didn't have a yoga mat carrier. I survived the yoga class without embarrassing 5,000 years of Indian culture. It doesn't feel very Indian. My friend Naveen Chandra calls it bionic disco yoga. But he thinks yoga's Hindu roots are still there.
The vast majority of yoga teachers have studied Hinduism more than I have, or my parents have. And I'm learning more about the meanings of the shlokas and the intention of Hinduism than I ever knew as a kid growing up being taught Hinduism from my community.
Even back in India, yoga has not been such a big deal. Kate Churchill, director of the documentary Enlighten Up, interviewed yoga pioneer Pattabhi Joyce at his school in South India.
And we might as well have been at the Puck Building in New York or something. I mean, there was over 100 Westerners, and there wasn't a single Indian, Sandeep. I mean, we were looking around and saying, like, well, where are the Indians?
But things are starting to change. The Indian government is filming hundreds of yoga poses so no one tries to patent them. People are practicing yoga at call centers and other workplaces.
We saw in large cities like Mumbai, for example, that there are power yoga studios cropping up because Madonna does yoga. It has nothing to do with India. Whereas if you go to a power yoga studio here in the U.S., you know, they'll say what you're doing is a 5,000-year-old ancient practice.
I hear they come to your homes now in India to teach you yoga. Private lessons. And it's the real thing. They learned it from American DVDs.
Back to neutral, double pigeon. Keep your left shin over.
Commentator Sandeep Roy is host of New America Now on KALW in San Francisco. You can comment on his essay at the opinion page at npr.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. 3 films open limited runs today, squeaking into the box office just in time to be considered for the next Oscars. The Spanish drama Beautiful, a romance called Blue Valentine, and an English ensemble film titled Another Year. Critic Bob Mondello says none offers much holiday cheer, but all have performances likely to be remembered at awards time.
You can't usually guess much about films from just their opening dates, but one week every year, the calendar tells you a lot. The week between Christmas and New Year's. That's when studios open potential Oscar nominees that are downbeat enough to be completely out of sync with the season. Last year, Germany's White Ribbon opened after Christmas, telling a story about abused children abusing their elders. The year before, it was 2 films about Nazis. Just not a cheery time. So it's nice that Mike Leigh's characters at least try to put on a happy chubby face in another year.
You're nice and slim.
Am I? Well, I've always been slim, haven't I?
Unlike me, middle-aged spread.
Shut up. You're perfect, gorgeous in every way, and you know it.
That's Tom and Jerry, a middle-aged couple with a strong marriage, a thriving garden, and a warm home that seems to attract damaged souls, chief among the damaged, Mary, who is hard-drinking, belligerently chirpy, and always on the make.
You could put an ad in the paper.
Gorgeous girl. No, mature woman with cat. No, mature-ish. We don't want to put them off, do we?
Leslie Manville plays Mary with brimming eyes and such an endless store of false bravado that you start waiting for her to come apart almost the instant you meet her. Because Another Year is directed by Mike Lee, her collapse isn't so much a full-fledged breakdown as a barrage of tics, quivers, and frantic glances, pain that's echoed by a grand array of British character actors who've worked with Lee in films with titles like Happy-Go-Lucky and Life is Sweet. In Another Year, the sweet life is much sought after, but is enjoyed almost exclusively by Tom and Jerry. Their solid marriage meets its opposite in Blue Valentine, a devastating little indie drama about a young couple who are hopelessly unsuited for matrimony, but who met cute and were adorable together at first. Cindy was a med student, Dean a high school dropout when they went on their first date. He was a charmer, and she was charmed.
You got any, like, talents?
Like, hidden talents?
Here, I'll play a song and you dance. I can't really sing. I have to sing goofy in order to sing. Like, I have to sing stupid. Okay?
Okay.
She starts a little soft shoe, concentrating on his silly voice when she should have been listening to lyrics about the pain of romance.
You always hurt the ones you love. The ones you shouldn't hurt at all.
6 years later, they're married, Dean drinking every morning as he heads to work, Cindy so frustrated by his lack of ambition that she's all frowns, except in public.
What are you doing here?
Oh, you're an awful friendly right now, aren't you?
No, I'm just surprised to see you.
Oh, this is where the smiles happen? This is the smile room? You take off, you leave me, and don't tell me what's going on?
Blue Valentine cuts back and forth between the past's limitless horizons and a marriage shot in suffocating close-up, as Ryan Gosling, open to a fault, and Michelle Williams, emotions tightly held, let you feel the throb of remembered joy when they argue, and let you see glimmers of trouble in every kiss. Solitary pain in Another Year, marital pain in Blue Valentine, and a pain that seems to embrace the whole world in Beautiful, spelled B-I-U-T-F-U-L. It's from Mexican director Alejandro González Iñárritu, the guy who brought us complicated tales of woe in Babel and 21 Grams. Here, things are simpler, centering on a stressed-out but loving father, played by Javier Bardem. The film's first scene has him whispering in the dark with his daughter about a diamond ring. May I put it on, she wonders. Yes, it's yours now, my love. Tender, sweet, a far cry from the Barcelona street life this father lives. Out there, he's a hustler recruiting illegal immigrants to push sweatshop counterfeits, never more than a half step ahead of the cops. Beautiful hammers this earnest hustler with a world's worth of illness, corruption, and betrayal, until Bardem, tall and strapping at the outset, seems to wither physically under the onslaught. When that whispered opening scene is repeated at film's end and you understand the circumstances, it feels breathtakingly different. Your perception's been altered by a performance as beautiful, in its anguished way, as the vivid ones that light up Another Year and Blue Valentine. Together, their year-end cry of cinematic distress qualifies as an exhilarating testament to film acting, though probably not one you'll want to catch all in one burst. I'm Bob Mondello.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. As 2011 approaches, we're looking back. And this morning, we're looking back at the most closely watched economic number of the year. The unemployment rate was 9.7 as the year began, and the economy has been creating jobs ever since. Yet at the end of 2010, the jobless rate is even higher, and no one is feeling good about the labor market. NPR's Tamara Keith explains.
Each month, the Labor Department releases new data about the nation's employment situation. That includes the unemployment rate and whether the number of jobs on payrolls went up or down. And most months, President Barack Obama responded to the data.
We've now seen job growth for 4 months in a row. This is the fifth month in a row that we've seen job gains.
The sixth straight month of job growth in the private sector.
The eighth consecutive month of private job growth.
Nine straight months of private sector job growth
for 10 straight months.
November marked the 11th month straight. On average, the private sector created 100,000 jobs a month this year. But as the president said almost every time, it wasn't nearly good enough.
As I've said before, the only piece of economic news that folks still looking for work want to hear is you're hired.
Dismal and pathetic and dire.
That's how Cliff Zukin describes the labor market in 2010. Zukin is a professor of public policy at the Heldrick Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers.
The job creation compared to the amount of people out of work is a drop in the bucket.
There were about 1 million jobs created, but 15 million unemployed. Another 9 million are working part-time but want full-time jobs. Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, says in 2010 the labor market was running hard but going nowhere. Zandi says the economy needs to generate about 150,000 jobs a month just to keep up with population growth and people re-entering the workforce. It didn't do that in 2010.
It wasn't negative. We weren't hemorrhaging jobs, but in the context of 10% unemployment, standing still isn't all that great.
Just ask Jack Warner. He lost his job in the auto industry 2 years ago. He's going back to school to get new skills and still checks job search websites every day, hoping for leads. I asked him to describe his year in jobs.
In one word, I guess I would have to say frustrating.
How many job interviews have you had in the last year?
One.
Warner is an IT professional who specializes in mainframe computers, and there just aren't that many jobs left in his field. His one job interview was the week before Thanksgiving. He hasn't heard anything from the company since.
I thought it went well, but I guess not.
Warner is about to join the 99ers. It's a term for people who've received 99 weeks of unemployment benefits and aren't eligible for any more. Warner's benefits run out around the first of the year, and he's not sure what he'll do. Many of the jobs created in 2010 were temporary positions, some 260,000 of them. In May, Trenda Kennedy landed a job in the mental health field after months of unemployment. Healthcare was another major growth area in the labor market this year. 2 months later, she was laid off.
So I was very crushed, but fortunately, another person on our team decided to take another job, and so they called me back.
She says the job has been great, but it's going to be a long time before she forgets what it felt like to be unemployed.
When my boss called me into his office the other day, I just thought, oh no, here we go again. I'm going to get laid off again. You know, something has happened, and, you know, no, it was a project, but still, your mind goes down that path.
Looking forward to 2011, many economists believe the unemployment rate will drop to around 9%, or about double what it was before the recession began. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer, in for Steve Inskeep. In these tough economic times, governors are warning of state budget cuts to come. The single biggest expense for most states is public school funding. Districts across the country have been making drastic cuts to staff and programs. NPR's Kathy Lohr visited one rural Georgia district coping with the new budget realities.
Franklin County in northeast Georgia isn't far from the South Carolina border. About 3,800 students attend school in this rural district. Nearly 60% of them qualify for free or reduced price lunches. Ever since Ruth Odell took over as superintendent 3 years ago, she's been dealing with shrinking budgets. She trimmed staff salaries, furloughed teachers, and got rid of employees' dental insurance. But she avoided cutting teachers until now.
It got so bad this year that we had to go down and actually eliminate positions. And that was the hardest thing, you know, that I've ever done.
Odell cut 9 full-time positions, and among those to go were some of the music and art teachers.
What shape is this?
Square.
Okay, is it flat?
No.
I try to pack a whole lot into one lesson.
Kathy Mitchell has been an art teacher for more than 20 years. The kids call her Miss Kathy. She used to be a full-time teacher at one school. Now she teaches part-time at two schools. On this afternoon, she passes out clay to kids so they can learn to make their own shapes.
I'll try to make a cube. I'll try it.
Mitchell knows all districts are cutting non-academic areas, but she says things like music and art help kids learn and make them want to stay in school.
So in this age of testing, I think it's important to their emotional well-being to be able to have the arts where they can express their feelings and their ideas, not just, pass and test.
To save money, the district also cut 20 days from its calendar and lengthened the school day by 40 minutes. Parents say that extra time has been hard for some kids, especially younger ones. Cindy Roach has a daughter in fourth grade.
She's tireder at the end of the day. And of course, that puts them on the bus a whole lot longer, too. Many times, they get on the bus sometimes even at 6:30 in the morning. And then some of them maybe don't even get home till close to 5 o'clock.
It's saving us $300,000.
Superintendent Ruth O'Dell.
That sounds sort of like a drop in the bucket, but that's four more teachers probably.
Georgia has been cutting school funding for years. Then came the recession. That forced districts to slash even deeper. And some analysts predict the next fiscal year may be the toughest yet for schools. Nick Johnson is with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington.
The emergency aid that the federal government provided, which has protected hundreds of thousands of teaching jobs, is starting to expire. And when that money runs out, it'll provide an additional hit on these school districts.
When O'Dell came to Franklin County, the graduation rate was 58%. Now it's 72%. O'Dell says she's tried to preserve those gains and the core of what schools do, the basic classroom curriculum.
We have to be very careful that we don't slash and burn in education to the point where we're years catching up. That's the last thing we can afford.
And that's sort of where you are now.
Right. This is a crucial year in our country.
The Franklin County Superintendent is collaborating with teachers and parents to evaluate the effects of the shorter school year. But officials realize they'll have to make a decision about whether to continue before they know for sure how it has affected student achievement. Kathy Lohr, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. This week, we're looking back at significant developments of 2010 in the world of science. Or perhaps we should say in the otherworldly field of astronomy, which had a record-breaking year. Scientists found more than 100 new planets more than ever before, and a few of the planets look enticingly like our own cozy Earth. NPR's Dan Charles reports.
20 years ago, nobody knew if there were planets outside our solar system. Today, we have a list of more than 500 such exoplanets. This past year, researchers announced they'd found whole solar systems with 3, 5, or maybe even 7 planets. 2010 also brought us the first discoveries from NASA's official planet-hunting instrument, a telescope in space called Kepler. The Kepler team has announced just a handful of new planets so far, but there are hints of hundreds more. But don't try to tell Mark Kushner that discovering planets has now become routine. Kushner is an astrophysicist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center.
You could say giving birth to babies is routine, right? In the sense that it happens all the time. But if you're the person who found the planet, it's not routine for you. It's still, my heart skips a beat every time I hear about one of these things.
Because finding a new planet still feels like science fiction becoming fact. Those distant balls of gas or water or rock represent the possibility of other worlds, other civilizations. And this year, for the first time, scientists say they've found a planet just far enough from its star that liquid water could exist there.
Finding a planet like ours is exactly what got me into this game. I don't just want to find a planet like ours. I want to know the answer to the question, are we alone?
Now, don't expect an answer to that question anytime soon. Most of these planets still are invisible. We only know they exist because they change the light from their stars in subtle ways. For instance, if the light from any star dims slightly in a regular pattern every few days or years, it's a signal that a planet is orbiting that star, blocking a bit of the light every time it passes. Astronomers can then calculate how big the planets are and how far they are from their star. Also, when the planet comes between its star and us, a tiny fraction of the star's light passes through the planet's atmosphere, like a sunrise or sunset around the edge of the planet.
And that light, we can analyze and we can use it to tell us about the chemistry of the atmosphere.
Is there oxygen there? Methane? Ammonia?
That is a whole new era in planet science.
Alicia Weinberger is an astrophysicist at the Carnegie Institution of Washington.
There's been just a tremendous number of papers that have come out in the last year and even before that on trying to characterize what planets are really made out of.
Also, it is now possible to see a few distant planets directly. Astronomers can create a kind of artificial eclipse of a star inside a telescope, and then sometimes planets come into view, faint dots moving around the star. What all these techniques reveal is a shocking amount of planetary diversity. Again, NASA astrophysicist Mark Kushner.
There are planets that are similar to things that we have in the solar system. There are planets that are so different we didn't dream of them. I mean, we literally just didn't think of them, that there could be such crazy things out there.
A planet turned up recently with an atmosphere rich in carbon. On a planet like that, diamond might be as common as rocks are here. Astronomers used to think that planetary systems had a natural order, with small planets like Earth close to the star and stately gas giants like Jupiter far away. But then they found lots of huge planets right next to their stars, zipping around in superfast orbits.
So that is still a real puzzle.
And Alicia Weinberger says figuring out how such planets formed is just the kind of puzzle that scientists love.
You know, fields in which there's nothing left to figure out are really no fun at all. And I think the exoplanet field has been attracting lots of really bright young people because there are these really interesting problems to solve.
They're also looking forward to using a powerful new tool. NASA is building a big new space telescope, 100 times more powerful than the famous Hubble Space Telescope. Astronomers get a kind of dreamy look in their eyes just talking about it. So for them, it was probably the worst news of 2010 when NASA announced in the fall that its Dreamboat telescope was going to cost $1.5 billion more than expected. The agency has not said how it will cover the cost overrun or whether it still hopes to launch the telescope within 5 years. Dan Charles, NPR News, Washington.
Jacques Pepin has wowed fans of his cooking shows on PBS for years. With his magic knife, he's carved tiny roses out of tomatoes and little mice out of olives, dicing and slicing with lightning speed.
We've been talking to chefs this week as part of our occasional series, The Long View.
And Jacques Pepin is one of the original celebrity chefs.
His star began to rise in Paris in the 50s, where he cooked for Charles de Gaulle and in the kitchens of the city's best eateries.
When he arrived in New York in 1959, it only took 2 weeks before the young French chef was befriended by the new food editor at the New York Times, Craig Claiborne. Jacques Pepin's circle would soon include the dean of American cuisine, James Beard, and the influential food editor, Helen McCulley, who introduced him to an unknown cook named Julia.
Helen told me, oh, I want to show you that manuscript here someone sent me. And I look at the manuscript of French cooking, and I said, this is pretty good. She said she's a real big woman with a terrible voice. And, of course, that was Julia. So that's how I met Julia also. And at that time, of course, no one knew Julia Child because she had never done a book and she had never done television. But I remember the first time that I met her, I spoke to her in French more than in English because her French was better than my English at the time.
We have, of course, how could we not? We have a clip of you and Julia Child, Julia and Jacques cooking at home.
Oh, yes?
From your public television show. Let's go ahead and hear that clip.
This chicken, I've washed it with hot water. And if we take in the...
I don't wash my chicken.
And he doesn't wash his. I think in France, they're not as worried about things as we are they?
Well, I live in Connecticut, pretty far from France.
Well, that's right.
Before I ask you about washing chickens...
But she was funny because many, many times, I mean, through many, many years that I've knew Julia, from 1960 until she died, I have never saw her wash a chicken except from that time, so...
Just at that moment, she had to wash that chicken.
Yes. Well, you know, she loved controversy. And when we cooked together, she would tell me, taste. And I taste. She said, what do you think? I think it's fine. She would say, it needs salt. And conversely, you know, if I say, I think it needs salt, she would say, no, it's fine. But we enjoy that type of bantering.
Jacques Pepin could not have envisioned his life as a celebrity chef when he was a boy in the south of France. He was introduced to a professional kitchen in his mother's neighborhood restaurant, but Pepin remembers being introduced to the pleasures of food even earlier. It was the Second World War. Food was scarce. His father was off fighting in the resistance, and to make sure her sons got enough to eat, his mother sent young Jacques and his brother to a farm for the summer.
My mother took me to introduce me to the farmer and his wife, and she was milking the cows in the stable there, and the cows were smelling. But I remember also the warm milk, which the farmer gave me a glass to drink, and it was really lukewarm and very creamy and delicious. And that was probably one of my first memory of food.
Much of your childhood was spent in the midst of a war. All around you, there was the deprivation of not enough food. So I gather your mother had to conjure meals out of practically nothing.
Yes. I mean, my mother, who is still living today, is very miserly in the kitchen. I mean, she can't cook anything. But, I mean, my father had left to join the resistance, and my mother, on her day off, would go 30, 40, 50 miles from one farm to the other, trying to beg people to get a little bit of food here and there, a few eggs, a jar of jam or some bread or whatever. But, you know, we were not that unhappy. For me, that's the way life was.
In your memoir, you describe your mother as making do in a very creative way. I love the story where she boiled beets to get something sweet.
Yes, it's interesting, actually. She made sugar with beets, you know, just cooking the beets in water, making it to a puree and reducing the puree, eventually doing a kind of molasses, you know, out of it. Interestingly enough, I remember my brother and I, after the war, asking my mother to do that. And she said, no, I don't know how to do it anymore, and I don't want to do it. And another thing that I would remember from my father was the fromage fort, we call that, is the strong cheese, which we still do at home. Actually, my wife does. Every 6 months or so, she goes through the drawer where the cheese are and scrape out the mold and all of that, put all the cheese together with garlic, white wine in the food processor to make a paste out of it. That often we put on bread and put under the broiler. So again, that would be a dish directly from my father.
After the war ended, your mother let you drop out of school when you were 13 to become an apprentice.
I wanted to get into the kitchen. So that's when I went into apprenticeship in the summer of 1949.
So that would have put you at 13 going on 14. But a kid, I mean, it seems to us today like a tough job for an adolescent.
It is, but I didn't look at it this way, you know, because home was actually a restaurant. So already, you know, I was used to peeling potato and peeling string beans and washing dishes and working in the kitchen with my mother as well as my two brothers. It wasn't such a big change. In fact, I loved it from the beginning.
Do you think that chefs who never experienced that long apprenticeship, do you think that they missed out on something?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Not necessarily, no. We learn very, very differently now than we used to learn years ago, because we learn in a different way. We learn through repetition, through osmosis, you know, looking. The chef never told you what to do. He would say, do this. And if you are there to say why, he would have said, because I just told you. That was about the end of the explanation. So you would work like that for weeks, months actually, and all of a sudden the chef, as it happened to me, told me, okay, you tomorrow you start at the stove. I was terrorized because I said, I don't know anything about the stove. And somehow I went there and I knew how to do it.
This month you celebrated your 75th birthday. Looking back over the many years, back to your mother's kitchen, is there a dish that brings that time back?
Not one.
You know,
maybe the greatest thing of all is bread and butter. Anyway, I mean, if you have extraordinary bread and extraordinary butter, if I have a bottle of wine and if friends are around, this is what I call enjoying life and cooking together. And I don't think you can cook well or enjoy a meal well unless you're friends with the people that you're sharing it with.
Jacques Pepin. His memoir is The Apprentice, My Life in the Kitchen. There's an excerpt at our website, plus the chef's festive recipes for New Year's. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.